Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, an hour-long conversation. I'll just call them the Weiss brothers, or the Doctors Weiss. Dr. Bob Weiss, a regular guest here on the program, and his brother, Dr. Roger Weiss. We're going to be discussing Christians and medical directives, sometimes called advanced directives. Why are these important to Christians? I mean, we do live in an age where if you write it down and sign it and have it notarized, someone has to pay attention to it sooner or later. But is that all we're talking about, is just leaving a living will for yourself? What's the difference between a living will and a medical directive? We're going to be talking about all of that during this hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the next, where are we going to go here? Oh, in the third hour of the program, we're going to spend some time talking with Randy Thomason of the Campaign for Children and Families based in Sacramento, California. Of course, a story out of California now is this judge's ruling yesterday against California's ban on gay marriage. We will be talking about that, hearing a little audio as well during that conversation from California. And then, in the last half hour of the program, two guests, a representative of National Right to Life, will be with us to get an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. We're talking about, how long did you say it was, Bob, before the tube is pulled from Terry Schindler Schiavo?
In general, starvation, depends on what books you're reading, say 7 to 11 days, maybe as much as 2 weeks, but usually 7 to 11 days.
So the time frame for Terry Schindler Schiavo is growing shorter and shorter by the day, and we'll get an update on her condition in the third hour of the program. Dr. Patrick Gray will join us for a lighter treatment of some very serious subjects, heaven, hell, and God himself, and the comic strip The Far Side. Dr. Patrick Gray of Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Dr. Bob Weiss, you just heard his voice, is professor of practical theology and professor of pastoral ministry and the life sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Bob, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me.
And a little bit later, we're going to be joined by his brother, Dr. Roger Weiss. He's a board certified in internal medicine and geriatrics and medical director of the Alexian Older Adult Institute near Chicago. He'll join us in a little while. Bob, let's start out bringing it to the Terry Schindler Schiavo situation. Would we be talking about Terry Schindler Schiavo today? Would she be in the condition she's in perhaps today if she had an advanced medical directive?
The medical condition, advanced medical directive, is not going to change a medical condition except if it says, look, I want you to go ahead and administer respiration equipment, hydration, nutrition stuff. If the advanced medical directive, for example, and her husband would have been determined to be the agent, that is, one who would make the decisions for her, if it's determined by the medical community, including psychiatrists and psychologists, that she cannot make this decision on herself, then he would have made this decision some time ago. The tube would have been pulled out several years ago, and then she would have died.
But if she had put in place a medical directive in advance of her collapse that said, I wish to be fed and given water throughout the course of my natural life, regardless of my condition. Maybe no respirator, maybe nothing beyond that, but feed me and give me water. Would Michael Schiavo be able to try and take her life now?
No. I mean, this would be her quote-unquote last will and testament. This is her testimony. She would have signed this. This would be a legal document, and the only way he possibly could have done that is to try and go to court, and this would be up to attorneys to discuss this, and say, look, this isn't really what she meant, but the law community, the court, the tort law situation in this would say, no, this is what she said, and we're going to have to do it. We're bound by this unless there are medical situations like organ shutdown and things where she is, in fact, dying.
What is a medical directive? Explain it to us in layperson's terms.
Well, a medical directive usually is divided into two areas, one called medical directive, i.e. living will, and then medical directive, i.e. durable power of attorney for health care. The very first one, the living will, came on the scene first back in the late 60s through the Right to Die Society out in California. This was a medical directive specifically designated for people who are terminally ill. And it is a foregone conclusion that these living wills were very nonspecific. Really, they only sort of guided the doctor, but really didn't tell him what he needed to do under specific circumstances. And again, to repeat myself, they were designed for people who were terminally ill, those people who were designated, i.e., say, maybe 6 months or less to live. Well, having examined that over the last 35 or 40 years, you know, they said, look, this is not working. We need a durable power of attorney for health care.
What does that mean?
That means durable means long-lasting, simply that it's going to be attached to a living will, or it could just replace the living will, and it would designate whether or not I want extraordinary means to sustain my life, or I do not want extraordinary means to sustain my life. And they would designate then either one or two people within the family that know this individual that could make these decisions when they become incapacitated. That is, they cannot make a cognitive, competent decision on what they would like to have done in terms of their health care.
So, in other words, if I were to, through the right legal process, name my wife, should she still be competent to do so at the time?
Yes.
As possessing durable power of attorney, if I'm incapacitated, she would have the ability to make decisions for me, just as if I were making those decisions myself.
Yes, and sometimes this goes under what's called surrogate rule, where you have one who is acting on your behalf to do what you are unable to do, and that is to make decisions that would specifically designate your caring, which could mean hydration, nutrition, respiration, and not terminating your life unwillingly or, say, intentionally because, well, they've lived long enough and this is enough. But
some of our listeners might be disturbed to hear that the living will as a concept had its origins in kind of the sinister right to die movement, and they might therefore conclude, well, then maybe these medical directives aren't a good thing.
Medical directives, now this is my opinion, they do place, a living will certainly places a great burden on an individual to sit down and to say, this is what I want, this is what I don't want. Physicians tell me, they say, well, you know, they bring some comfort and some hope, but that's about all they do. Now, when my brother Roger gets on here in a half an hour, you can ask him, you know, what's the value of a living will? I pretty much know what he's going to say. And then what's the value then of having a surrogate health care director where you appoint someone? I think what people are trying to do, we would hope, is not to control whether or not they're living or they're dying, but they are seeking good health care for them. So the living will in and of itself, when people go into the hospital, I just had a young lady see me a few days ago, and she said, well, when I went into the hospital, they made me sign a living will. You don't have to sign those. They don't have health care directives, that is to say durable power of attorneys, unless you have someone present that can sign it, and then, of course, has to be notarized. So it is a bit alarming to know the history behind all of this.
Has there been a problem as these things have kind of legally evolved, and then, of course, that crosses over into every hospital or every clinic? Has there been a problem with the medical community, and in particular doctors, wanting to abide by what someone says in an advance directive? For instance, someone says, I do not want any extraordinary measures, and then he lines it out. I don't want to be put on a respirator. If it means me dying without the respirator, I'd prefer to die that way. I do not want to be put on any other kind of extraordinary mechanical life support. Continue to feed me and give me water insofar as I can continue to take it, but nothing other than that. And the doctor says, no. I want to put them on a respirator. I want to try and save their life or keep their life going. Has there been a problem with that?
The problem, of course, is that the doctor has to honor the wishes of the family and has to also, unless there is a competing principle where the doctor says, look, since if they have no legal document, he can say, this person is not going to die, this person will recover, and so the other burdening issue is, why do they want to commit suicide? Why do they want to kill themselves? There's, again, a problem, you know, the question under the question here. They may call in a social worker to help work through this. But if, in fact, this is down in writing, and it is something that the individual says to the doctor, and they're competent to say to the doctor, well, I don't want this. I just want to die. the doctor will probably, and Roger can address this better than I, say, I think we better talk about this, because there are situations where one competing principle, like do no harm, can outweigh one person who says, I want to bring harm to my body. And that's where health ethics committees come in at, where they say to the person, look, we have to take care of you. We are here in the caring business, not the business of allowing you to commit suicide or to kill yourself.
We're talking with Dr. Bob Weiss about Christians and medical directives. He's professor of practical theology and professor of pastoral ministry in the life sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. If you have a question or comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So let's sort this out just at this point here, Bob. Living will, medical directive, advanced directive, health care directive. Are we all talking about the same thing? Are all these terms referring to the same thing?
No, they're not all referring. Again, a living will is legally different than the surrogate laws that Missouri has or Illinois or California has. A health care directive, durable power of attorney, is different than a living will. A durable power of attorney attached to a living will says, I want my wife, my brother, my sister to make decisions on my behalf if I am unable to make those decisions regarding my health care. And attached to that, then we could also say that for Christians, we would encourage them to attach a Christian affirmation statement that says, I believe, teach, and confess in the Christ, and I don't want anything done to my life that is going to hasten my death. I want my death to be in Christ and not to be a suicide and so forth. So these things can be added to those.
So why would a Christian want to add a statement like that to what would otherwise be kind of a sterile legal document, as important as it is?
It is a sterile legal it's a sterile document. Mm-hmm. It's only a Christian witness. That's the bottom line. I have several in my office that many people have given to me and said, here, I want you to keep this, show this to your students. I can think of one gentleman, Vern Hoiker, who gave me his Christian affirmation that he had attached to his durable power of attorney for health care. And it basically laid out, I'm a Christian, I believe in Jesus Christ, I was created, Christ has restored me, he sanctifies my life. It's just simply a Christian witness.
So it is also, if someone says, well, why didn't he want to have the feeding tube removed, it answers that question. This is what he believed.
This is what he believes. And I must tell you that according to the American Medical Association, where I've calculated maybe 35% of all physicians belong, and that's it, the AMA Code of Medical Ethics says that nutrition, hydration, respiration are artificial means. That, of course, is addressed, you know, well, why is it artificial? It's artificial because we have to write the prescription, we have to administer it. So they don't consider it natural. And they call, you know, hydration and respiration and nutrition, I call it food and water. And the sad side of all of this, of course, is that anytime you withhold or withdraw food and water, it is universally fatal event in medicine. And this is a huge dramatic step. And this is what will happen to Terry Schiavo unless someone intervenes.
So this is different. The Schiavo case has often in the press been likened to the Karen Ann Quinlan case. But Karen Ann Quinlan was in a coma, one. Number two, she was on a respirator. And that respirator was removed. She was not deprived of water and of food in the years that followed after she remained alive after being removed from that respirator.
No.
Are they a one-for-one comparison?
I guess when you get down to the bottom line, and not medically certainly, they're not one-for-one, but from the standpoint of the use of these created terms back in the 70s of persistent vegetative state, yes, they would both fit those criteria.
But I'm wondering about the circumstance where you said that the removal of the feeding tube and water, food and water, is a universally fatal event.
You will starve to death.
But the removal of a respirator may not be fatal.
That's exactly right. It may or may not be fatal. And one doesn't know, because usually when those are removed, they try and wean you off. And sometimes a person that they think has need of this constantly is in fact not in need of it, and think, whoa, they can live without this. But they do need food and water, you know, hydration and nutrition. And the discussions I've had with people is that they don't like to replace nutrition and hydration with food and water. They say, oh, that's not the same thing. Of course, it is the same thing.
How did food and water come to be viewed by, at the very least, you said, they're at least the AMA as some sort of extraordinary measure to be taken near the end of life to sustain life, rather than what you do with people when they are living and they can't feed or drink for themselves.
Well, this gets into the terminology of extraordinary, and ordinary. For example, just to kind of review, people who have need of insulin, that is a very ordinary treatment for them. For me, it would be very extraordinary. And so the AMA comes along and says, well, but food and water and hydration are very extraordinary because if the body is shutting down, they don't need it. So it's very extraordinary. And so we're going to have to write a prescription to give it to them. It's not ordinary under the medical circumstances. It's extraordinary, or they would even use the phrase non-essential. So we look at it differently. We say, but wait a minute. This sounds like almost an oxymoron. Food and water and respiration are very essential.
By that rationale, as you've put it there from the AMA, that would mean food and water is extraordinary for each and every one of us. In other words,
within a medical condition, yes.
I mean, they couldn't find any compelling reason if I were suddenly unconscious for some unknown reason to simply not feed me by that rationale.
By that rationale, they could say it would depend on your medical condition and what's happening, because as my brother would share with you, when he deals with someone who is dying, for example, you can't allow someone to die unless they're dying, and dying usually medically, and Roger, again, can address this much better than I can, is usually based on organ shutdown. Medical cases are incredibly complex.
But in a case like that, Bob, just to bring it again around to the whole food and water thing. In a case like that, I've, as a parish pastor, had cases where the very infirm or the very elderly, say in a nursing home, who had been giving food and water through, granted, artificial means, where the doctor said, this is now harming them.
Yes.
We have to remove this because this is now hurting them. Their body can no longer take the food. They can no longer... their digestive system is shutting down, and we will do more harm than good if we continue to put food in their stomach or water in their stomach.
Yeah, treatments can be useless. We don't continue, as you've mentioned, to give someone an IV drip of any type of fluid or feeding tube when the stomach is ulcerated, this tube keeps clogging, their kidneys have shut down. That becomes a useless treatment. Treatments don't necessarily in medicine mean cure. Treatments sort of help along with the process of taking care of an individual.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about Christians and medical directives. Dr. Bob Weiss is our guest. He is professor of practical theology and professor of pastoral ministry at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. In a little while, before our conversation ends, we'll be joined by Dr. Roger Weiss, his brother, a board-certified internal medicine and geriatrics physician and medical director of the Alexan Older Adult Institute near Chicago. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. You mentioned a term earlier there, Bob, persistent vegetative state. Tell us what you can about this.
Well, these were terms that were developed back in 1972 to try and get at what was happening with an individual that was awake but not responsive. And so they drag up this word vegetable, you know, and not only persistent, but then they also talk about one who is permanent. Persistent sometimes in medical terminology may very well mean maybe we could bring the person back from this state of being awake but not responsive. And for example, like Terry Schiavo, she's awake, but according to some doctors, she's not responsive, and that has to do with what's happening in her brain. But she's not brain dead. So these terms, I think, to be quite frank, are very disgusting terms because neither one of us, especially us here in the studio, are vegetables. And it's an incredibly demeaning term. It has found its way into the medical community. Back in the middle 1990s, the AMA never used the term persistent vegetative state. They would talk about an individual who is permanently unconscious. And now, because this has become part of the political correct way to deal with someone who is awake but not responsive in some cases to everything, to all stimuli, we have to give them a label that says persistent vegetative state. And this, of course, says, well, if they're that way, their quality of life is not very good. They have no value and worth to society. Therefore, we can get rid of them. So really, that term says a non-person is a non-issue.
So the word vegetable or vegetative, to your way of thinking, dehumanizes the human being.
Unquestionably. So I try and encourage the students that I teach, avoid that. They will hear it in the medical community. A lot of meaning well people will use it because it's part of our vocabulary now. But I encourage them to talk about someone who is unconscious, but they're awake, but maybe not responsive.
Yeah, I've heard the term non-responsive.
Yes.
So, and that's really far more accurate and descriptive. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Paul is on the line from High Ridge. Paul, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Hi, Bob. I just wanted to mention that not too terribly long ago, in terms of years, and I'm talking less than 30 years, most states that I know of, it was illegal, it was a capital offense to withhold hydration and feeding. And somehow, over time, these ideas about humanity and you know, the worthiness of an individual, of the Greco-Roman, perhaps, thought, have crept into our laws, and most people are not cognizant of that. And, you know, I don't know how many organizations now where I think members, for instance, the American Nurses Association, the American Nutrition Association, all have as statements, opinion statements, where they say, oh, it's okay to withhold feeding, tube feeding. It's okay to withhold hydration as long as you give good oral care and you touch the patient.
Paul,
think something's gone awry and people really have to wake up to it.
Thanks for the call, Paul. How did it go from being a capital offense to starve or dehydrate a person to death, any person, to, you know, fall under the rubric of now we're being compassionate? Is it that this person ceased to be a person in the mind of those who are formulating these things?
Oh, unquestionably. I think this ties into the view, and I know I've talked to Paul about this, this ties into the view that if you do not see the embryo as a human being, and it has no respect, it has no honor, well, it needs some moral consideration, respect. But if you lose respect and dishonor for the embryo, you soon lose it for every developing human being, including the embryo, simply because they really are not a person. They are not, yeah, they have a body, sort of, but it's not a body and a soul. And if it doesn't have a body and soul, it really isn't an issue to deal with.
Folks, it really is. I think it's striking to just note here at this point in history that after 32 years of decriminalized abortion in the United States, where we said, look, what will they contribute if they are born into a poor family? And they'll require so much care and so many of our resources. Exactly the same arguments made at the other end of life. If you dehumanize the person at the beginning, you can just as well dehumanize them at the end. We're talking about Christians and medical directives. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The primary task of the Christian preacher is to deliver Christ himself to sinners. Christ's perfect obedience, his suffering, his death, his rest in the tomb, his resurrection and ascension for sinners. Christ in holy baptism, Christ in the Lord's Supper, Christ in the word of forgiveness for sinners. You'll find example after example of this Christ-centered, cross-focused preaching in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, selected sermons of Dr. Norman Nagel from Valparaiso to St. Louis. This book is $24.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Liberal members of the clergy don't like President Bush's proposed budget. They say it doesn't reflect their values. What exactly do they want? Keith Peters attended one of their rallies in Washington yesterday to find out.
The Reverend Bob Edgar of the National Council of Churches asked a crowd of around 150 people how President Bush's 2006 budget could possibly be moral when there are other investments that need to be made.
Are we investing enough money in our children?
No!
Are we investing enough money in public education?
No!
Are we investing enough money in health care?
No!
Is our minimum wage high enough for the working poor?
No!
Edgar called for access to quality child care and health care and wants the government to ensure a livable income. Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America takes issue with the liberal clergy criticism of the White House. She says the Bush budget is moral because it focuses on defense of the nation, clearing away the deficit, and most importantly, strengthening families.
This is the secret for building a strong society. You've got to have strong families. You've got to have communities who are concerned about the kind of opportunities people have for getting out of poverty, and that means strengthening families.
She says that means more than shouting slogans.
We have to look at what is best for the nation, what strengthens the nation internally and externally, and this is a budget that does that.
The Senate will begin floor discussions of the budget resolution this week. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
The rally followed a joint statement last week by five mainline churches calling the Bush budget unjust. The group includes the Episcopal Church USA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Church of Christ, and the United Methodist Church. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
How many people who call themselves Christians really don't like to go to church? They see it as a requirement, and they resent the expectation. True believers don't go to church to fulfill an obligation. They go to receive the blessing of promise. And once they understand the magnitude of the promise, wild horses couldn't keep them away. We don't have to go to church. We get to go to church. There really is something to be said for the truth. AM 850 KFUO, serving you and the rest of the world. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March features sermons preached by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Norman Nagel and is titled Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel on our website, issuesetc.org. Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Christians and medical directives. We've spent the last 25 minutes with Dr. Bob Weiss discussing kind of the general parameters, the circumstances that people find themselves in, and why it's important that a medical directive be, well, why? What are the pitfalls of the medical directive, and why it's important that Christians consider this, especially in light of all of the end-of-life issues that are so much in flux when it comes to the ethics of medicine nowadays. Dr. Bob Weiss is professor of practical theology and professor of pastoral ministry and life sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We're also joined now for the next 25 minutes by Dr. Roger Weiss. He is board certified in internal medicine and geriatrics, and he is medical director of the Alexian Older Adult Institute near Chicago. Dr. Weiss, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Hi, Rog.
Hi, Bob.
We have spent quite a bit of time here talking in general terms about medical directives. Let's talk about why it's important for a Christian to have a medical directive. And if so, what should they be aware of when they're trying to forge one of these things out?
Well, certainly from my perspective as a physician, Christians and the Christians I deal with, their faith is of paramount importance. And their relationship with Jesus Christ is of paramount importance, and they need to be able to direct those around them to make sure that their value system is honored in the dying process.
So let's talk about the kind of particular things as a physician that you see in your dealing with end-of-life issues that come into play for medical directives? What are the biggest things people need to be looking at when they think, okay, what's going to be happening to me in those last weeks or months or even years?
Technology is such in medicine today that it's likely that 40% of people are going to die in a hospital, and they're going to be very ill at the end of their life when most resources are utilized, and a lot of those resources are very high tech in terms of keeping hearts and lungs and brains at least going on some level. Many of my patients who average age anywhere between 85 and 103 at this point really want to be assured that they will not be a burden to their families, that they will not linger in a dying kind of suffering state, but they will be able to live their life to the fullest, and a directive can help them meet those goals.
We might be under the impression, Dr. Weiss, that it doesn't make any difference what you tell the family and the physicians to do in advance, that it's kind of a blank slate, and morally a blank slate, that as long as you put it down on paper, anything goes. Hey, I do want to be starved to death. I'll sign my name, the notary puts his stamp on it, and that makes it okay. How would you counsel a patient who says, you know, the real paramount thing here is that my will be done?
I think that the most important thing I can tell them is to make sure that the relationships in their life with their loved ones are in good shape, and that the people making decisions for them when they can no longer make their decisions are really following their wishes and their will, and that is done based on the quality of the good relationship they had before they started to die.
Let's discuss withholding or withdrawing treatment with the intent not to kill, but to care. How often does this really happen?
It happens quite a bit. Certainly in the age group that I deal with, in terms of very advanced age, with sometimes a lot of very chronic and severe disabling illnesses such as end-stage Alzheimer's disease or end-stage lung disease, there are many instances where people are just existing in their own minds and don't want to be fed extraordinarily. They may not want to be reintubated after being intubated once and put on a ventilator or kept alive by any kind of artificial means, and they made that very clear in their directives.
And as from the physician's perspective, if you have a medical directive, if a patient has a medical directive in place, what does that mean you can and cannot do? How does that direct you as a doctor?
It means that I've done my homework in terms of counseling the patient, in terms of what I would recommend and advise them in terms about establishing that directive. It means that as long as the patient and I are both, you know, reasonably together on what they want and what they don't want, I can honor their directive. There are instances where patients may want me to do something such as euthanasia that I cannot participate in. So then we cannot meet at that place. So I can't follow just everything that they want, but I can certainly work with them, and the patients that do have a directive under our care, we really need to be on the same page about what they want and what they don't want.
Is it a relief in a sense? I'm just thinking about it. If I were in the physician's coat for a while, whether or not it would be a relief to have a patient walk in and say, I've got a medical directive.
It's a very much of a relief, because doctors often find themselves in the never-never land of an intensive care unit with children and loved ones without a directive, in very difficult situations, for instance, with a severe stroke where the prognosis is terrible but unending. We don't really know where this is going to lead or how long it's going to take to lead to its inevitable end, and the family doesn't know what dad would want, what mom would want, what their loved one would want, and that it's very difficult. Under those circumstances, 99 times out of 100, everything will be done.
And is that usually at your recommendation, or is that the family saying, we don't know what he wants, so let's err on the side of caution?
It's usually at the family's direction, but also certainly with the medical input of what we think is feasible and best for the patient. I mean, there are instances where, you know, what the family wants in terms of invasive or life-extending procedures may actually be causing pain or harm. and then we have to find some way through that.
Raj, we went over a little bit of the history of the term persistent vegetative state,
mm-hmm.
or permanent vegetative state, that was initiated by a couple of women in 1972. What is, in the medical community, well, certainly in the lay community, these terms tend to be viewed as dehumanizing. How are they viewed in the medical community?
In the medical community, so much can be done technologically. You don't run across them very much, certainly in the arenas that I practice in, because so much can be done. It is very unusual to find an individual in a, what might be considered a persistent vegetative state, especially with the ways of assessing people and determining whether they are responding, whether they can hear you or make contact on some level. It's very difficult to say that that is simply not happening or not possible.
Is there a qualitative difference from a physician's standpoint between someone who is nearing the end of life because they're 103 years old and someone who's nearing the end of life because at, say, 60, they're diagnosed with a terminal disease and their prognosis is not only bad, it's short?
There is definitely a difference between those two cases as a rule. People of faith who have lived long, good lives often are preparing for death, and if something happens that may take them, they consider that part of the life process, and so they are able to, you know, die in a way that is actually edifying to themselves and their family because it's part of life.
How specific I'm sorry, go ahead and...
No, go ahead. I was done with that.
How specific does a medical directive have to be?
The more specific it is, the better. A living will, for instance, is something that's designed to be at the very end of life in a terminal condition. So much of what we see nowadays is not in that kind of a state, but in a an arena that we would consider palliative care, or when we don't know exactly what the prognosis is, pending all the technology that can be applied, and you need someone with a very specific directive saying, I designate my brother to be my directive. I've discussed with him what I want done in terms of under what circumstances do I want to be fed and by what means. Do I want IV fluid? Do I want to persist in that kind of state? They can be very specific, and the more specific they are, the better. And all family members should be involved, not just one, because there's sometimes conflict between one or the other.
We're talking with Dr. Roger Weiss, board-certified in internal medicine and geriatrics, medical director of the Alexan Older Adult Institute near Chicago, and his brother, Dr. Bob Weiss, about Christians and medical directives. Taking your questions and your comments on medical directives, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Cindy is calling from South County. Cindy, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Could you please tell me if medical directives run out or expire? I don't know if I'm saying this right. If you have something written like 10 years ago, is there a certain amount of time that it won't be effective anymore, or should they be updated at a certain amount of time, and like when would that be?
Thanks, Cindy.
Sure.
Roger, take that one if you would, please.
Yeah, and certainly my experience, they do not run out. They are in force until the person who made them revokes them or alters them or changes them. Now, that can be done verbally at almost any point in time, and they're always good to be updated because situations do change, people do change, their mindsets change, new data is brought to light, so it's always good to update them. But they do remain in force once they are executed.
Regarding that specificity, and Bob, feel free to jump in here as well, too, it sounds as though if you're going to sit down and really do a medical directive that will be of use to you, your family, and the physician who's caring for you in the last days of your life, you need to be with the doctor and, it sounds like, a lawyer and the family all in one place discussing all the little details.
Yeah, I think if you can work it out, that's fine. Rarely that's a possibility, at least in my experience. Usually attorneys have examples of these, or certainly with durable power attorney for health care, you can get Christian affirmations attached to them. I know Lutherans for Life has those available. The Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod has a great way of dealing with these. They have these Christian affirmations attached to the durable power of attorney for health care for every state in the union. And those can be bought, for, I think, for $5 and then taken to your attorney. They can work them over. You always give a copy to your physician so that they have access to these. But frequently, and Roger can deal with this, the physician, unless it's in the record, the physician's not going to know about it.
Roger, anything to add?
No, I agree with Bob completely. Unless it's in the record, we may not know about it. If we do know about it and it's not in the record, it makes it very difficult for institutions and physicians to act on it. And I still think the relational aspect of this and knowing what your patient wants, knowing what their family wants, and everybody being on the same page and updating that periodically is essential. Attachments and things to the power of attorney, durable power of attorney for health, are good, but it's difficult sometimes to interpret them in the heat of battle, so to speak, in the emergency room and the intensive care unit. And so it's very good to have much of that, your mind clear on what the patient wants before you ever walk in there, and then let it be modified by the situation.
One person I did not include in that list of the people that we consult is the pastor. And nothing against pastors. I'm one of them, but I wonder how qualified as a pastor during my parish days I would have been to make a good advice there because of kind of a big blank spot in my knowledge and my understanding of these issues. Do you wish, Roger, that Christian pastors were better equipped to sit in on those consultations?
I sure do, and I think that certainly when it comes to death and dying issues, faith is absolutely critical to a good death. And you need your pastor there. You need someone there who has that kind of emphasis and viewpoint to walk the family through the practical issues of dying in terms of faith. And that's very helpful in terms of sometimes even determining some of the technology that may be applied. And it would be great for pastors to have that kind of training.
And I think, too, that we have to keep in mind, and Roger and I have talked about this extensively, is that the pastor is a pastor and the doctor is the doctor.
Right.
And that the pastor can learn a lot of medicine from physicians, but we all have to keep in mind that what the vocation God has placed us in, that's where we work, so that when issues of, if a person says, well, is it life at all cost, pastor? The pastor would say, no, we don't worship the body, we worship the Creator, and there are times in medicine, and if we had more time, where things, and we've talked about this, have to withdraw or be withheld when the treatments are credibly useless.
Now, I do want to get to that before our time does run out. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tim in Chicago listens on the Internet. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks for dealing with the issue. I was wondering if Christians have any obligation to refuse treatment that may in the future be developed at the expense of other human beings, such as embryonic stem cell research. Thank you.
That's a brilliant question. Let's have Bob take that one first. Tim's question.
Yeah, I think if one is going to be consistent in their Christian life and their walk with the Lord, and they believe that the embryo is a human being, and I certainly affirm that, then dealing with the embryos that would be killed to save somebody else, we would say would be an inconsistent witness of one's faith that all life is to be cared for, created by our Lord, redeemed by Christ, sanctified by His Holy Spirit, so that I think a Christian would, I certainly would not accept tissue from embryos that have been created and then destroyed. That gets into the issue of what's called complicity. So we would then be complicit.
And Roger, in the medical community, how likely is it that those kind of treatments that would require the death of other human beings to save lives will be available to people where the lawyer says, so do you want X treatment or Y treatment?
I think it's very likely, and I think it's not the lawyer that will offer that, but the physician. And I think it will be done without a second thought by the doctor, because most physicians, at least in my experience, believe that that is a reasonable application of technology to save people, with very little attention given to the root of that or where that might lead or the certainly the God issues of that.
Yeah, and I don't want to misinform, because the gentleman that called previously was talking specifically about embryonic stem cell research.
Right.
And we're talking about, for example, organ donors,
mm-hmm.
you know, people who would like to, when they die for whatever reason, say donate their corneas or kidneys or something like that. So we don't want to mix those two together.
Right.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It is Bob now calling from his car. Bob, welcome.
I'd like to ask Professor Weiss on stem cell research or stem cell, using stem cells. My understanding is that the stem cell is implanted in the egg. The cells from an existing human being is implanted in the egg, and this is what you are calling an embryo. Is that correct?
What actually occurs is that if you can just imagine sort of an egg, and you remove the genetic material from a woman's egg, and then you take the genetic material, say, from a skin cell, and you take that material and put it into the egg and let it develop until the fourth or fifth day, then you have created what are called stem cells. They're part of the actual embryo.
Right. It sounded as though Bob was getting a few things mixed up. He was confusing human cloning with the harvest of stem cells. Stem cells come 10, 15 days later after the cloned human has been created, and that isn't genuinely a human embryo, yes or no? Bob?
Yes, the stem cells are taken out at about the fourth day after it's been cloned, or we can certainly talk about adult stem cells at some other time.
Shirley in Centralia, Shirley, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes. My mother was 91 years old when she had a massive stroke and a light heart attack. The doctors, and I happened to have my pastor with me, sort of pressured me, I guess is the way I felt, that she needed to be fed, that, you know, she would be starving to death more or less, and yet she needed the feeding tube versus the other method of food. And I felt tremendous pressure that the decision on the fact that she was 91, the quality of life versus, you know, someone needing this, and yet she was at that point in time of her life. I was just wondering if you had any comments on when you get to that stage and they're talking about that she does need feed, but yet at the same time that's a very difficult operation, you know, to have, and you're at that stage of life.
Roger, your response?
I really believe that it's the spirit of the law and not the letter of the law that needs to be honored for most of my patients. I believe that most of my patients have clearly communicated they do not want to be kept alive at all costs for whatever reason at the very end of their lives. And that's not all, but that's most. And so, you know, we try very hard not to pressure people or cause them to feel pressured by either placing a feeding tube or removing a feeding tube or suggesting one or not suggesting one. People need to be able to do what they feel is best for themselves within the moral value system that we operate in.
Roger, how much should doctors be injecting their personal feelings about a patient into the situation like this? Statements like, well, she has lived a long life, or perhaps she deserves better than this, something along those lines.
Well, I think that all doctors have personal feelings about their patients, and, you know, we need to assent to those, but we need to have the patient's best at our inner core. And so my personal feelings certainly get involved, but, you know, that is modulated by the data, by the clinical situation, and by what my best effort is to understand what my patient wants and what is possible.
Rick calls from Hebron, Indiana, and he is listening on the Internet. Rick, welcome.
Yes, my question really deals with how do we deal with the medical research community or the medical community in general and the choice of the language that we use. It seems to me if we want it, we'll call it human and we'll use humanizing language. And if we don't want it or we want to use it for our own purpose, then we'll use dehumanizing language.
Thanks, Rick. Bob?
Yeah, this gets into what I talk about in my classes where, again, Rick has brought up the ends justify the means. If, in fact, we can justify the use of humans to save other humans, which would mean, and I'm talking embryos in this case, or any person, and say, well, you know, they've lived a long enough life, let's just let them go, we can use their liver and spleen, then basically the ends justify the means. And if, in fact, we find that, well, they really have purpose here in life, so we're not going to keep the same terminology that we have so that we don't dehumanize them. And I think in terms of dealing with the medical community on this and the philosophical community who's always jumping in here, it may very well be that we have to assure them and be consistent in our use and don't jump into their ship and be inconsistent with the use of the language.
Roger, two quick final questions for you here at the end with about 30 seconds on each. First of all, are you concerned as a physician about the direction of medical ethics today?
I am concerned about the direction of medical ethics. I think it is not modulated, and it is seemingly more directed by technology than by even compassion or reason at times.
And finally, why should Christians have medical directives?
To protect their values and their wishes at the end of their life. To protect their faith and all that they've treasured up to that time.
Dr. Roger Weiss is board certified in internal medicine and geriatrics. He's medical director of the Alexian Older Adult Institute near Chicago. Dr. Weiss, thank you for being our guest.
You're very welcome.
His brother here in Studio A, Dr. Bob Weiss, is professor of practical theology and professor of pastoral ministry and the life sciences at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Bob, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Now, this is difficult to sort through. I've done show after show on the issues of medical ethics, end-of-life issues. We've even done a fair number of shows on this kind of a subject, although not particularly on medical directives, on the whole end-of-life conundrum that suddenly comes spilling out in the pressure cooker of the intensive care unit or the nursing home or the hospital room. And some people might be tempted simply to throw up their hands and say, look, it looks to me like it's just shades of gray. And we can't really navigate our way through that in any real way. No, there is. And there is a way to navigate it, but that means you have to look at the map before you set out. And that's what the medical directive is. Essentially, thinking the hard and difficult and uncomfortable and awkward thoughts about what will be those moral decisions, those ethical decisions lay before your family, your physician, your friends in those last hours and days. You owe it to them as well to give them that direction based upon the sound counsel of God's Word. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be coming back in the third hour of Issues, Etc. to talk about the California gay marriage issue.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.